The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me this week, taking some time off from shouting at his builders, is James Baggett. James, lovely to have you.
Thank you, John. It's lovely to be back and not doing real work for a few days.
What are you saying?
Well, I said, having smashed up my house for 2 weeks, I realized that is a lot harder than sitting in front of a computer writing stories and talking about them on a podcast.
Very true. That's not to say that what we do is not skilled work.
No, that's true. Sorry. I'm not talking that down in any way. But the skill of putting in cable clips when you're clipping up wires is very, very difficult. When the 10th one didn't go into the crumbling walls of my house at the weekend, I took to the wall with a hammer like an axe murderer and thought at that point, it's probably time to give up building and hand it over to the professionals.
And possibly call a therapist. But apart from that, yeah. Well, I don't know when we last saw you on this podcast, 3 weeks ago, possibly.
Yeah, I think so. A couple of weeks ago.
Been a busy time for news.
It has.
I'm sure we'll get on to. How's your week been in terms of writing lots of news?
It's been good. It's finally been getting back into the swing of things. Talking to a few contacts and a few stories coming out of the woodwork. Thanks to that, it's nice being back on the phone talking to people and just hearing what's going on out there. It's been a mad week for news, isn't it? I know we always say that, but this week, I mean, I know I was listening to your podcast last week, and you were saying it was a little bit quiet, wasn't it, last week of August, but we're just getting into start September now, kids going back to school, and just things start to happen again, don't they? And I think we've sort of seen that this week, haven't we?
And of course, happy plate change day.
Indeed.
Celebrate.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, 73 plate out today. Lots of dealers, very, very busy. I saw a tweet from a used car dealer, and it was just a picture of one of their salesmen with a massive smile on their face. And the caption was Khaki, obviously Jamie's team. And the caption was that realization that you're a used car dealer and you haven't got 43 new car handovers today. Which I thought was perfect, just about summed it up.
That is very true. Right, well, I will introduce our guests because I think we've got quite a few stories to get through, one of which has just broken as we started the podcast. Our guest this week is CEO of CarWow, John McManus. Welcome, John. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's John. Good to see you.
Nice to see you,
John's.
I'm going to invite James round to repair my house, actually.
I haven't seen his workmanship firsthand.
Especially if you need cables clipping, I'm not your man. So how are things in, John, in the hot seat now?
Yeah, I took over from James back in July, so 2 months in, and really, really enjoying the new role. I'm spending a lot of time with partners, actually, so it's been great and traveling up and down the country, spending time with dealers on the new car side of the business, but also on Sell My Car as well, so it's been fun.
So tell us a little bit about, I mean, we obviously covered the news when it started. I mean, James is the founder of CarWow, has decided to take a step back, hasn't he? Just talk us through why that happened and why he made that decision and just how things are going to change now, if at all.
Yeah, and obviously I've been with the business for 2.5 years as COO. So James and I have worked so closely over that period. And, we've built the strategy together. And I think he's at a point where, obviously, as a young dad, or as a dad of a young family, he's keen to spend more time at home and really leave me to scale the business. Now, it's obviously grown tremendously well over the last couple of years, and we've still a lot more to do to make sure that we provide our partners with a great service, great technology to allow them to either sell more cars or buy more cars. And the rationale in some ways is that we can bring the commercial teams and the product and technology teams together. So previously I was looking after all of our partner relationships. James was looking after the product and technology. And we're now bringing that together so that we can, you know, build better technology for our partners. We've spent a lot of time, you know, trying to figure out how do we help people, how do we help consumers find the next car. Obviously, we've invested hugely in video, in content, in the configurator product. But my vision is really to make sure that we do a phenomenal job on the technology side of the house for partners as well. And that this change helps us do that perhaps at a little bit of a faster pace.
John, tell the people listening a little bit about your background and what you've done before joining Carwow.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm quite sad, James. I've always been working for 30 years, despite my youthful glow. I'm aging rapidly. So I actually, when I left uni back in 95, they called me up and said, "Have you ever been on the internet? We're looking for somebody to come and build our first ever website." And I said, "Well, I have been on the, I think I've been on the internet twice at that point." And so I managed to land the job, and I actually built the university I went to's first ever website. So started, learned to code, and built that, which was an amazing experience. Quite cool, a bit of a risk, I suppose, at the time, because so it's very few people actually online at that point. And I suppose that's a bit of a catalyst for my career. Ultimately, I think, you know, lots of people have a little bit of there's obviously skill and luck, I think, to anybody's career. And that decision, I think, just got me into the whole online space really, really early. Most recently, I've spent a lot of my career working for marketplaces. So I used to run marketing for Expedia back in the early 2010s. So a lot of experience operating performance marketing at massive scale globally. I then sort of passed into my 40s, had a slight midlife crisis, thinking, why have I never run a startup or a scale-up? And I left Expedia and went to a scale-up business in the UK called Farfetch, which is a luxury clothing marketplace. People say, "Well, you don't really look like you ever worked in a luxury clothing business," but I did, I promise. And there were many similarities between Farfetch and Carlisle. So Farfetch worked with small independent boutiques. Obviously, some of our car dealers are huge. But our job was to help those boutiques sell internationally. And we built that business up from around 400 people when I joined, up to about 4,500, and floated it in New York back in 2018. So, lots of marketplace experience. And, you know, Carwow for me is the perfect job because I'm really interested in the marketplace model in terms of how it can help all of our partners leverage all of those consumers that are moving online. How can we help get them back into dealerships? It's not about online versus offline. For me, it's actually about omnichannel retailing. You know, we know consumers are making choices across multiple touch points. And I suppose I love trying to figure out how we can build that, you know, brilliant marketplace model that helps partners. And, I'm also a bit of a petrol head or an EV head now. So combining marketplaces and cars is a perfect combination for me.
So tell me a bit about your vision for Carwow over the next few years. I mean, what is your it's been a very interesting journey, hasn't it, for you guys, especially with the recent, well, it's not so recent now, but the acquisition of the used car platform and how that's totally changed your business in some ways. What's next for the next few years? And I mean, what are you going to be driving forward?
I think ultimately we want to be the start point for anybody thinking about changing car. We want to be the start point for them online. So if you think about booking a hotel, for a large swathe of the population, they don't start with Google now, they go to booking.com. And that's the start point for booking your next holiday or trip. We want to be the destination that you think about coming to, the vertical specialist that customers come to when they want to change cars. And we think we're very credible at that. We run the world's most popular car YouTube channel. We've got so much written content on the platform. We can provide customers with a valuation for the car so they can figure out how much they can spend on their new one. We can help them navigate all of the choices, build a shortlist. We can configure pretty much any car on the platform now. And we will match that to a factory order, a new car in stock, or a used car. So it's the one place you can come to do everything. And I think that's really compelling for consumers as more and more of them start the research phase online because there's just immense choice now. And I think in doing that, we provide consumers with both the convenience of doing everything in one place, but also the trust built upon on the breadth of dealers that we have on our platform. They're the experts, I suppose, that once you get down to a shortlist can help you figure out, well, actually, what's the right sort of Audi A3 to buy versus a BMW 3 Series. So we can use our content capabilities, but also really leverage the expertise of our partners who are the absolute experts in helping customers make that final choice. And then I think for partners, to your point, we've had fantastic reaction from the used car platform, the Sell My Car platform. Obviously, massive demand for stock. And it's a very efficient platform because we have more than 8 million users on the platform every single year. And ultimately, if you're looking to buy a new car, you probably have one to sell. And we've done, I think, really well at efficiently building up a lot of used listings for our partners to bid on. So, really, I think an exciting time. And I think this is a great industry. There's obviously, to your point, there's lots of news, there's lots of change. And ultimately, I think at times CarWow has been seen as this disruptor, if you like, in its early stage. I think we've moved on from that entirely now. We're here to build really strong relationships with our partners. And my belief is, we are a very, very efficient marketing channel for so many of our partners, whether they want to sell a car or buy one. And that's because we're now at such scale.
You mentioned there about the disruptor, the tag, and I mean, over the years, it certainly has been. Dealers I've spoken to going back, there's some that loved you and some that didn't like you. I mean, I'm sure you'd freely admit that too. How does CarWow fit into a future that is going to be dominated by agency? Because it's a very, very different way of buying a car, isn't it? People are going to be directed to manufacturer websites. How does your business model fit into that?
And it's a good question. We already have a couple of examples live on the platform. So Volvo obviously made the flip to agency earlier this year and are active on our platform. So we are now sending across leads to the Volvo team. I think what's important for us is, I think in the early days, and perhaps some of that disruptor tag was focused on, we were a price comparison website. Mm. And our focus is to become a car comparison website. So if all the cars are if the car has a fixed price, consumers are ultimately looking across, well, actually, should I buy a used one versus a new one? Should I look at a different manufacturer? And that's really the investment that we're making to help consumers navigate, but also help our partners, raise visibility of the particular products that they offer, whether they be new or used. And that's a massive focus from a technology point of view.
And I suppose the content side of the business, I mean, John and I both know Matt very well. I work with Matt Watson at Auto Express. Actually, I was his protege when I was there. He taught me. I filled his role at Auto Express. So I know Matt very well. Very, very good friend of mine. And he's done an amazing job.
I've got, yeah.
An incredible job. You look at some of the videos he does, and when he releases them, they do huge numbers.
Yeah.
Just how important is that content from the YouTube side to your business and the wider editorial content you do? How important is that now, and how important will that be in the future?
Oh God, it's huge. I think Matt is a huge part of this business, and a huge part of why we've been so successful. And I think if we go back to our vision, ultimately, we want to be the start point for anybody looking to change their car. And the first thing most people want to do is figure out, what are my options? What are the cars that I should put on my shortlist? And I think Matt's done an amazing job of helping people build those shortlists in an entertaining, fun, and engaging way. And it's really hard to do. I think, it's an amazing talent. He's, has a massive impact on the culture of our business as well. He's great fun and we're really proud of the work he does. That is, makes a massive difference and drives, a huge amount of efficiency into our marketing because, we tend to find, people will ask me, well, the drag races surely don't, lead to people configuring cars. And there may be one or two people configuring Porsches on the back of it, but it keeps us top of mind with consumers. We are entertaining the nation. Yeah. And so when people think about changing cars, they come back to us because they know Matt can both entertain and inform. And You will see certainly over the course of the next couple of quarters, actually, we're spending a lot of time rebuilding and redesigning the site so that it feels more like the YouTube channel, actually. It's fun, it's entertaining and informative. And Matt's played a massive role, not just in terms of creating the video content and the written content, but also trying to inject more personality into every aspect of the experience.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to seeing the changes over the next few months. But thank you very much for joining us today and being our guest judge. But I think thank we you. Probably should move on to the many news stories we have, John.
We probably should. So if you haven't listened before, James and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each story as we go through. At the end, John gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can X at Car Dealer Mag and let us know if you think we've missed anything. Last week, James Batchelor was the winner, so I'm going to hand it to other James, who is here now, to start.
Well, thank you, Batch and John. Many stories to kick off with, but I'm going to go with the one that you mentioned moments ago, and that was the news that just broke. It was confirmed just before we came on air on this podcast. It's 10:30 on Friday, that Jardine Motors, backed by Lithia Motors, well, owned by Lithia Motors, the American giant dealer group, has bought Arden BMW and Mini and their Motorrad bike dealer in Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells. It's for an undisclosed sum, but just sees the Jardine business starting to make good on those promises that they had when Lithia took them over, that they were going to be hunting for new acquisitions. I'm just going to rewind the clock slightly to the Lookers deal, which is still going through with the Canadian-backed bidders. We've talked at length about Lithia possibly making a bid for Lookers. I wonder whether this deal means that's more likely to happen or less likely to happen. I think what we have seen from this is a statement of intent from Lithia. They've gone for Jardine Motors in March this year. £300 million they spent on that. And when you compare it to the 400 odd million that the Canadians are paying for Lookers, that looks like Jardine's quite expensive, doesn't it? But it shows you how serious Lithia are about the UK. They've added bolted on these businesses. It's a relatively small deal in the grand scheme of things, but I think what is important, it shows that doesn't stop here. The consolidation is going to continue, and Lithia wants to build a big dealer group here in the UK. Whether they can supercharge that acquisition trail with a big purchase like Lookers. I mean, they also bid for Pendragon, didn't they? But that was blocked by Heading. Whether that can happen still remains to be seen. But I think what we're seeing here is they are serious. They do want to grow. And I think they are the ones to watch. John, what do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting this, isn't it? Because it's, as you say, we had our eyes on the Lookers deal. And I think when you see they've put out a statement of intent of wanting to actively buy more dealers, we probably were looking for the big fish, weren't we, that they might swallow up. But yes, this is a perfectly acceptable other way of expanding, isn't it? Snap up little local dealer groups. I mean, this is, they're perfectly placed, really, aren't they? Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells, or Tunbridge, for BMW, it's home counties, premium cars. I remember, was it John O'Hanlon said to us, or Dash Gripser said to us, you know, if you can't sell, I think they had JLR and VW and Audi. Yes. Sell those in home counties, then you're doing something wrong. So yes. I think it slots nicely into Jardine's or Lithia's sort of new portfolio, doesn't it? So perhaps we'll see more like this.
A nice profitable business too, John. Looking at the accounts, just I think they're split up between the two different locations. But I looked at the Maidstone, Arden Maidstone Limited accounts, £76 million turnover in 2021. And profit before tax of 2.2 million. Well, that's not to be sniffed at. You know, that is a nice profitable single dealer for BMW and Mini there. They're clearly doing very well, and I can see why they were attractive. And there's lots of other big dealer groups that have grown like this, isn't there? I mean, Marshalls did it. Okay, they bought some big dealer groups along the way, but they snapped up some little ones like this as they grew. And Virtue has pretty much built their business on deals like this. So yeah, I think what we're seeing here is the start of another big business for the UK.
Absolutely. And of course, it slots in well to lots of manufacturers who want to consolidate their partners quite drastically. So I suspect BMW, I don't think, have given any sort of statement of intent of wanting to do this, but lots have. So yes. I suspect Lithia and Jardine are quite well placed to snap up some little ones that perhaps would have been encouraged out of various dealer networks as the years go by.
I think so. John, what do you think on this one? I mean, Lithia's name has been bandied around a lot, hasn't it, when it comes to the acquisition market in the UK. Do you think they'll go for someone big? Do you think there's a big deal in them?
Well, goodness, it's a difficult question to answer, actually. I mean, I think there's some brilliant retailers in the UK, so I can understand why they would be so interested in this particular market. And I think, you know, many of the dealers, I think, represent, you know, good value. They're really, really well run businesses, so I can understand their interest in this market. But yeah, difficult to say what the next steps might be.
Yeah, I know. It's just we're guessing, really, aren't we? But I mean, I honestly do think that there is a big deal in them. I really can see them swooping on a big dealer group, and I think they're taking the easy pickings at the moment before they go for the main course. Well, John. That's my quick story for you. But yeah, broken this morning, confirmed at 10:30. And now
hot off the press.
Yeah, absolutely. Hot off the press. Breaking news. John, follow that one.
Well, I'm going to follow it with some big news, possibly, which is Big Motoring World boss has refused to rule out rumours he's buying used car supermarket rival Available Car. So Big Motoring World, everyone knows Peter Waddell and Big Motoring World, expanded quite rapidly over the last few years, but he again has sort of put out a bit of a statement of intent of with some new funding that he's had, they want to increase their footprint across the country. So there's been a bit of a rumor that he's swiping in for Available Car, which has four sites. They're sort of Leeds, Castle Donington, is that sort of near Derby somewhere? They're up in the north, basically, which is where Big Motoring World isn't really at the minute. Big Motoring World has obviously started in Sittingbourne in Kent and has spread out North London, still Kent, Peterborough, etc. So this would slot in nicely to their portfolio. Nobody is telling us whether this is happening or not, but it seems like it might be. If I hand this over to you, James, since you...
Well, I did. I mean, I messaged Peter about this, as you can imagine, and I asked him the question. I said, is this true or not, Peter? And he sent back a two-word comment, which was no comment, but it was the emoji at the end, which was a smiley kissing face that kind of sort of gave it away to me. I mean, I couldn't obviously put that into the story.
Does he not normally send you those?
He doesn't know. I mean, well, sometimes maybe the odd kiss, but I mean, this one was quite telling, I thought. I mean, I asked him, I said, come on, you've got to give me something better than that. But he said, I'm not allowed to talk to you just yet, were his words. So, I mean, read into that what you will. But I saw that Robert Forrester tweeted yesterday that it was interesting to see Peter Waddell's helicopter had landed in a hotel in Leeds, which is very near the head office of Available Car. So
maybe he just fancied a little trip to, you know, the White Rose Centre or...
Maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't the best of days, was it, weather-wise, to be up in a helicopter? probably wouldn't have wanted to do that myself, but maybe this was a very important meeting for Peter and he had to be up there. We did try and look into the tracking of his helicopter, didn't we, to see quite where it was.
Unfortunately, he keeps buying new ones, so it's quite difficult to work out which one he now owns.
Of course he does. He's now got 55 of them, allegedly. No, he hasn't. Oh, dear.
I mean, the interesting thing about this, of course, is, as we said in previous podcasts, it looks like a sector of the market that is struggling at the minute, car supermarkets.
Yep.
And yet, Big Motoring World seems to be sailing through very happily. We had their results not long ago, did we?
And they were quite... £10.9 million profit, a rise of 65% on the year before, on turnover of £529 million. So actually, when you look at that compared to the likes of Motorpoint for the same year, who lost £300,000, that is quite a performance. And you've got to remember also that Peter sold out a large chunk of his business to venture capitalist Fresh Stream last year, I believe that was. And they've said that that was all about accelerating their ambitious growth strategy, their words in the press release, not mine. So I think this is probably highly likely. He bought SW Car Supermarket, didn't he, last year, which added two in Peterborough to his portfolio. They've clearly worked nicely. He's opened in Wimbledon at a former Mannheim site and sold a huge number of cars that he shouted about on LinkedIn from there. So I can believe this. And actually, the thing that makes me believe it is if people like Peter Vardy and Motorpoint are saying that this area of the market is tough and Peter Waddell was doing a very good job at it and is confident that he can do it, then he might be getting a bargain. You never know. I did send him a message this morning. Did you get the deal done? ? Not answered. No emojis. No emojis returned. So
perhaps you should have been more specific.
Did you get the deal done for the new helicopter?
Oh, yeah, there you go.
So, John, another rumor story. What do you think of this one? Could you see it happening?
Well, I think first and foremost, the due diligence in tracking helicopters is impressive. evidence gathering, quite amazing.
Stone unturned.
Exactly. I'm going to check you're not tracking my car. I think to your point, it would make a lot of sense. I think a deal like this, obviously Peter runs a tremendously well-run business. I've been up to the prep center and it's really, really impressive in terms of the utilization and the pace at which they prep cars and get them to site. So you can see that expanding the number of sites, particularly in the north, would seem good business. And again, to your point, James, if Peter and team can apply the same unit economics that they've seen in the existing sites, that would make for a great business. So yeah, it seems like a great thing to do, and the direction of travel, particularly the helicopter, seems quite clear.
Mm. Yeah. We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights. Right, I'll move on, shall I, John?
Do.
Okay. And I'm going to move on to a survey story, which I quite like because they often give some very interesting takes on things. And this one came from someone we haven't heard from for a while, John. It's Cazoo.
Oh, I remember them.
They did a survey about used car buying, funnily enough. Apparently they do that. And it was, I found it on their website. Wasn't very widely publicized. They hadn't sent it to us, but I found it anyway. And it's about used car sellers finding, they say, job interviews and exams are less stressful than selling a used car. So they found the activities that used car owners would prefer to do than sell their car. And the respondents said that they'd actually rather move house, take an exam, plan a wedding, do their tax return, were all preferable to these 2,000 respondents than selling a used car, which I thought was quite interesting, really, because there are so many ways to sell a used car, aren't there? Mm. You know, notably many sites like Cazoo or our esteemed guests from CarWow, you can do it there too. There's lots of ways these days to do it easier than it ever has been. I can imagine it was a bit stressful when you had to advertise it yourself privately, but there's now so many routes to market, motorway and the likes. I can't really understand why people find it so stressful.
Do you know, I think this is a not inaccurate, to use a double negative description of how most people find it. And I don't know why, because as you say, it sounds completely nonsense, doesn't it? What's more stressful to you, James? Buying a house, as we were discussing yesterday, how stressful you found buying your last house compared to selling your cars, which you do quite regularly.
Well, I'll tell you what was more stressful is putting those little clips into the wall of my house. That's definitely more stressful than selling a car.
God.
Okay, aside from that. But I mean, I think most people are, what we forget is a lot of consumers are slightly scared of the motor trade, whether that is dealing with a car dealer or dealing with a private buyer. You know, like I look at my mum, who I mention every week on the podcast for some reason.
You're not John's mum.
Absolutely. But, you know, she was dealing with somebody's, helping some with somebody's estate sale recently after a death. And there was a car to get rid of, and it was all a bit sort of complicated of, oh, right, well, what do we do with this? How do we do it? What's the best way to get the best price? Da, 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 da. In the end, it was a, well, I think we were going to go to, they were going to go to like a We Buy Any Car motorway type thing. I can't remember what they did. But it is, it's the stress of like all the paperwork and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I suppose if you're not used to it, it could be stressful.
Yeah, I mean, I personally don't think it's that stressful. But then I say that, I've probably should have sold my car about 5 years ago, and I've moved house twice in that time. So perhaps I do find it slightly stressful as well. In the same way that selling anything on eBay is slightly stressful because, you know, people bid and then don't buy it, or say, well, especially they turn up Facebook, and don't.
Facebook Marketplace, steer clear.
Yeah, exactly.
There was one stat in this survey that I thought was an absolute gem from Cazoo, and I tagged it on the end of the story because I couldn't help myself. And it was Cazoo's own research says that the majority, 49% of respondents, would prefer to take their car to a dealer to have it valued. Cazoo, the online only used car dealership.
So what would happen if you took your car to a Cazoo customer center for that?
Well, they don't exist. There's not many of them exist anymore.
Well, true. But I think you'd be turned away, wouldn't you? Or someone will come up with a laptop, perhaps, to sort it all out for you.
John, please, what do you think of this one? Is it? Do you think people find it so stressful?
Well, goodness, my my middle son's currently preparing for his exams, and I definitely don't think it's as stressful as that. Hey, you know, I think some consumers definitely, we have similar research that would suggest around a half of customers find the process stressful. And I think, to your point, there are a few unknowns, I suppose. First of all, trying to determine, you know, what is their car actually worth? And it obviously has a material impact on them, particularly when they're thinking about buying a new car, because it's one of the biggest drivers of that future budget, I suppose, in terms of what they're going to buy. So I definitely think that's quite stressful. And, you know, we're really focused on trying to help customers navigate some of those unknowns, I suppose. So if those customers upload their car onto our platform, then they have multiple dealers bidding. And I think that gives them a sense of reassurance. And I think to John's point, they're not having to deal with private buyers. I think that is really complex and potentially full of pitfalls. And I think most consumers would prefer and accept that if you're selling a car to a dealer, you might not get exactly the same price as selling privately, but that's a trade-off that's absolutely worth making, because you're dealing with somebody that's professional that will help you and, you know, ensure that the end-to-end process is pretty straightforward, and typically it is. So yeah, I think to your point, James, as more and more services evolve, hopefully you see stress levels start to diminish.
Yeah, I definitely think it's easier than it used to be. That's
yeah,
sure.
But, yeah, and I think that's borne out in evidence by the number of, you know, things that have come in to help people. I mean, 20 years ago, we didn't even have We Buy Any Car, did we really? It was walk down to a local dealer and hope for the best.
Yeah, I think consumers have got so much more choice now, so that definitely helps. And I think it's just more transparency, more information, and that ultimately reduces the risk, doesn't it?
And the opportunity to make proper money for it by selling it to the trade. I think that's another thing that's changed. I mean, We Buy Any Car notoriously offered low in the hope that people wanted to sell and make it easy. And that was how their business operated for a long time. But, you know, people such as yourselves, people like Motorway, do it differently. You know, a bidding system gives the consumer a better deal. And yes, it's still a trade price, but it's going to be a much better trade price than someone like We Buy Any Car would. So I think that takes out some of the stress as well, because people don't want to be ripped off. And I think in the past, people feel like they're getting a poor deal by selling it quickly. And that doesn't have to be the case now.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think often when new services emerge online, obviously they provide more transparency and support for consumers, whatever they're buying ultimately. I think what we've seen though with the likes of CarWow, with our buying service and also motorway is that it's a win-win for both the consumers and partners, actually, because you know, our partners are also getting access to cars. They can buy those more efficiently and quickly than other sources. So I think it has worked out really well, actually, for both sides of the marketplace.
Yeah. And I mean, and consumers can make the choice, can't they? They can decide to sell it to We Buy Any Car, or they can decide to sell it or sell it privately themselves. It all depends on how quickly they want to do the deal and whether they want the hassle.
Yeah. And I think ultimately Carwell and Motorway just taking out the middleman, I suppose, for a better phrase. And again, I think that's, you know, the technology is connecting consumers and dealers together, so they both win.
When you did that, were you with Carwell when that deal was done to do?
Yeah, I worked. It was the first thing I did, actually, when I joined.
So what was the thinking behind bolting that on? I mean, it was just coming towards the end of COVID, wasn't it? When there was a lot of problems with new car supply and new car sales. Was it a case of going, right, actually, we really need to be in the used car market? Or was it more the fact that it was always something you wanted to be in?
Yeah, I think it really came from two insights, I suppose. The first one, that our partners were asking for more used car stock, and I think that was definitely accelerated because of COVID, obviously, in terms of the reduction in new car volumes. So lots of partners were asking us to do this. And the second one is that, you know, there's a simple truth, I suppose, that if people are coming looking for a new car, they probably have one to sell. And so our marketing economics are more efficient on the back of that, because we don't have to spend, you know, millions and millions on brand advertising to drive listings for partners, because we already have so many active users on the platform every day. So and that allows us to keep our costs low for partners.
Yeah, certainly made a lot of sense, definitely. John, that's mine. Over to you.
Okay, I'm going to talk about probably the most popular story on our website this week.
Yes.
Which is ULEZ related, because of course it is, because the ULEZ zone came into effect a few days ago. Was it yesterday, day before? Can't remember. Monday?
Yeah, it was this week. Monday.
It was this week, anyway. ULEZ has barely been in the news, so I don't really understand why it's so popular. But this is used car dealers reacting to the ULEZ expansion. So obviously this is going to affect used car dealers, because a certain quantity of stock is now not ULEZ compliant and much less tasty to anyone who wants to go anywhere near London. And of course, lots of people are trading in their non-ULEZ compliant cars for one that is ULEZ compliant to save themselves £12.50 a day. So the problem with that is dealers are now having to turn away, they say to us, non-compliant part exchanges, because they simply don't know what to do with them once they've taken them in. So we spoke to a few dealers in within the ULEZ zone, I think, didn't we? So yep. McCarthy Cars, Jim McCarthy was quite outspoken on this particular issue and said things have become, any diesels have become a real pain to shift, and that unfortunately ULEZ hadn't really pushed up the value of his petrol and, you know, compliant ULEZ stock, but was just pushing down any non-compliant stuff. So they're effectively turning things away because they don't know what to do with them or who to sell them to beyond this point. Of course, we have got the ULEZ scrappage scheme, but that is sort of separate entirely from dealers, isn't it? You have to apply directly to London Council, whatever it's called, Transport for London.
TfL.
Exactly, TfL. You scrap it yourself, you submit a scrappage certificate, and then they send you £2,000. So it's actually quite an involved process. And I don't think that is something that dealers can do on behalf of customers, or certainly can't do for themselves, because to be able to scrap these cars for the £2,000, you have to have owned it and be the registered keeper since something like January 2022. So this doesn't seem to be as well thought through a scheme as the previous scrappage scheme, where, you know, that drove customers into dealerships, didn't it? Admittedly, new car dealerships.
Makes a good headline for them, though, doesn't it?
It's true.
James, what do you think about this? Well, the thing with this one, John, is I read it and I thought, why are they turning away these cars? You know, I was thinking, you know, normally you would expect a dealer that comes in for somebody comes in for a deal and says, well, I would like to buy that one. I've got this diesel. You would get a price for it, wouldn't you? And if you did, it only depends if you're going to actually put that car on your forecourt, whether you turn it away or not, doesn't it?
Half the time you're not, are you? Because
otherwise, you'd think normally they would trade it on. Yeah. So I just wonder why these dealers are not trading it on or on marketplaces that cover the nation. So these cars can then be moved up to Scotland or you know, the north of England, where there are fewer problems and these cars are probably worth more. I just wonder whether these dealers that we spoke to, and there was four or five in this article, and they all said that they were put off by this sort of stock, whether they just find it a little bit too much hassle to do that, and whether normally they take the Part X's in and put them on their forecourt. And at the moment, that business model doesn't work because they'd have to trade it on, and maybe trading it on is something that they don't do. I know we didn't talk to a huge cross-section of dealers here, but everyone we did speak to said that they're turning them away. And interestingly, it's sort of like you say, it's really caught the imagination of readers, isn't it? It's the most popular story on our website. 70,000 people have read it this week. And even the Sunday Times have covered the story. I saw this morning, Sunday Times Driving have published a pretty much a carbon copy of our story, quoting us. So it does. It's really hit a nerve, hasn't it? But I just wonder why they're not trading these cars to other areas of the country. I mean, John, did that sort of strike you as a little bit strange?
Yeah, absolutely. And without plugging our service, obviously that it's a great place for dealers in London to be able to sell cars nationwide, where obviously the ULEZ doesn't exist, so you're likely to get a much better price for it. So I think more broadly, actually, I think for consumers, ULEZ, you know, obviously we all want cleaner air. I think that goes without saying, but I think just the overall approach is really challenging for consumers. I think there's just a lack of information. I think we posted a piece actually that after the High Court judgment back in July, I think a lot of people were waiting to see what happened with that judgment in terms of if ULEZ would actually go ahead. So we then saw a massive spike in consumers uploading non-compliant cars for sale. And again, I think that's just put more and more pressure on. I think lots of dealers are probably seeing this, you know, big uplift, and you know, it's challenging to deal with. Whereas if it was, you know, distributed over, you know, several months, I think for everybody, both consumers and dealers, it would have been a lot simpler to manage. And you know, again, you go back to the scrappage scheme, it's complex to navigate to understand if you actually qualify. And I think it's really hard for consumers that are, you know, many of the, obviously everybody's feeling the pinch at the moment, and this is really painful. If you rely on a car to get to work, take your kids to school, it's pretty painful. So I think
I can't help thinking, John, that there's a bit of a business opportunity here for some dealers. I mean, you'd think that actually they could get some real bargains, take them to an area where they're actually, you know, for example, non-compliant diesel SUVs, take them up to Scotland where they're probably worth a huge amount more money.
Absolutely.
There's probably a good opportunity to make some cash.
That's right. It's interesting, actually. You often think about non-compliant cars as being, obviously, they're of a certain age, but we look on the platform and, you know, some brilliant cars, actually. Yes, they might not be compliant, but there's some really, really cool vehicles. And to your point, I think there'd be huge demand elsewhere in the country. So definitely, I think there's lots of opportunities and lots of tools to try and sort of help consumers navigate that change, and potentially for partners to generate a bit of extra revenue as well.
Yeah, definitely. Right, John, I'm going to move us on, if that's okay with you. And I am going to pick a story which I know you definitely would have picked too. And that is the news that BYD have decided to delete the badging on the back of their cars that said, build your dreams. And I've chosen this story because we've had a discussion about this, haven't we, off air. And we said that the words was a little bit, how did you describe it? A bit live, love, laugh. And should actually be above the bed somewhere in Essex of somebody. Build your dreams. It probably, and I think you said it probably is. And I'm not surprised that BYD have decided to get rid of it. It came off the back of feedback from dealers and journalists and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I didn't have this story, but only because my reaction to it would have been just one word, which is good, and then I would have moved on. Because, I mean, it was inevitable, wasn't it? No one is going to buy something with Build Your Dreams written across the back in enormous font. It wasn't just across the back of the car either. It was like tattooed on the inside. It was all over the place. I think people are happy to just have BYD, which means nothing as far as anyone is concerned, rather than that.
It was just so much better, wasn't it? BYD was so much better. I think Ted, who wrote this story for us, he was out on the launch, wasn't he, of the
BYD Seal?
Seal. Dolphin, yes. Seal. What's next? Whale?
Manatee? I don't know.
Anyway, he was out there on MPB. The launch. And he asked the question, you know, why this was happening. And apparently in China, they don't see it as a problem at all. They think the build Your Dreams badge is actually a very, very good idea, hence why it was pushed so far. And unfortunately, sometimes it is that sort of kind of, just when these cars come to the UK, there are going to be these sort of problems, and they have to take feedback. And I think MG have done that very well. They've managed to feedback a lot to the factory and the design department, like what actually does work here on these shores, and as a result, been very successful. So nice to see they actually decided to listen to the dealers and the feedback they got here and get rid of that badging, because it was definitely the right choice, wasn't it?
Yes, and I'm sure we'll see, as you say, much more of this sort of thing. I think were you surprised when the Aura arrived, and it was, because there's various Aura cats on sale in China. We only get one of them.
There's
a white cat and a black cat and a something else. And I think, I can't remember
which
what
is called.
What?
A witch's cat.
Yeah, sure, etc. But why we've gone with Funky Cat, no idea. Not quite sure where that came from. Not sure if that's going to put anyone off. I think we did possibly talk about it putting people off. But what's in a name? By any other name?
Well, everything, because I would not be seen dead driving something called the Funky Cat. It doesn't matter how good it is. Sorry, that's another one that they need to push and change. But yes, I was not surprised that this had changed. John, you did some research recently, didn't you? Your team into Chinese brands and what actually the opinion was of the car buying public. Can't actually quite remember the results. Putting you on the spot here, aren't I?
No, it's fine. Yes, we did actually. And I think generally consumers, I think to your point, there is a challenge that consumers are not familiar with the brands. And so I think how they're presented is really, really important. And, you know, I agree with both of you. I think good that BYD are listening to dealers and are changing the product so that the brand, you know, resonates with consumers in Europe. And I think that's the biggest challenge, I think, for incumbents coming into the market is just building awareness of the products and the brand and what it stands for, and obviously building a connection with consumers. And I know that's a big, big focus for all of the new brands coming in. But I think there is definitely, we're seeing really significant interest at those EV models at the price points that they're being offered. So the MG4. In particular, it's actually now in our top five most configured vehicles.
Wow!
So there's definitely a lot of interest in. I think there's huge interest. EV interest is definitely starting to pick back up again, and I think particularly at those price points. And so I think for those brands that can make a connection with the audience, there's a huge, huge opportunity.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of change over the next few years. I think it's fascinating to watch. Definitely, John. That's me finished on BYD and Build Your Dreams.
I will squeeze in one more, which is talking about, funny enough, electric cars. This is news from Virtue. Well,
I'm glad you brought that one up.
It's news that we have picked out of their results. Their results that we've picked it out of? Their latest trading update, I mean.
Yeah, later. Ahead of their half-year results, yeah.
There we go. So there's a line in this, which is, you know, as we know in results, there's usually some nice, tasty morsels for us to write about because in these results updates, companies have to be quite truthful about the situation on the ground. And this is about electric cars. So in their trading update for the six-month period ended August 31st, 2023, Virtue Motors said In the new retail and Motability channel, like-for-like volume growth has been delivered as supply constraints continue to ease. So good news there. However, it's me adding the however, recent increased supply of new electric vehicles appears to be exceeding retail demand, creating an imbalance in pipeline inventory coming into the key plate change month of September. Manufacturers are reacting to this through the offer of discounted prices and supported finance rates to stimulate retail demand. So in other words, petrol and diesel and plug-in hybrids, etc., all doing generally fine, but electric, there's too much supply and not enough demand, and manufacturers are discounting, says Virtue, which would be the first return of discounting in quite some time, as far as I'm concerned.
And John, I think picking up on John's point a moment ago, which is why I was going to pick this story too, is that, there is this sort of kind of disconnect between the existing manufacturers and these new challenger brands, isn't it? I mean, I think some of those existing brands with those electric vehicles look very expensive.
Yes.
And now everybody's bringing them to the market at a time when people are not particularly up for paying a lot of money for stuff. So I think when they are expensive, these cars do cost more than their petrol and diesel equivalents. People are going, well, I'll just stick with petrol for a little while, or stick with diesel for a little while longer. So yeah, I'm not surprised about this. And you know, Robert Forrester often says it like it is. We always says it like it is, and he clearly has done here. And it's a little bit of a worry, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I should add on to this. It's being supported effectively by the fleet sector, isn't it? This is what we've been talking about previously, but this is what the statement added. Fleet sector demand for electric vehicles remains robust and is currently critical to the electrification of the vehicle park, which I think is not accurate, is it? That's what we've said before.
But
the
only incentives
really for EVs at the minute are for fleet customers, which is a bit of a problem in two, three years' time, where the PCP or the lease or whatever runs out and suddenly we're flooded with all these electric cars.
Yeah.
Retail customers don't want.
No, and I mean, I've got some stats sent over to me about the price drops in EVs just since that price drop started. This is a story for next week and next week's podcast, but it's worrying quite how much they've dropped in the last 9 months. I mean, it really is drastic. And that hasn't gone unnoticed with the public and the motor trade. And it's very difficult for people to recommend them when they are dropping in value quite so quickly. And it does make finance rates very difficult to do, because those balloon payments on these cars are not quite as good as they would be if they've got much better residual values. So I think that's making them more expensive too. John, what are you seeing on your platform when it comes to this?
Yeah, no, exactly the same point. I think the one thing that's really interesting, actually, in terms of demand, I think if we move up the funnel, so people considering EVs, we're seeing real growth there, actually. I think what we're not seeing it turning into actual demand, I seem to be buying a car, to Virtue's point. And I think that's due to the points that you made, that you know, the residuals are challenging and that impacts the finance rates. I think for many of the cars, the sticker price is still high compared to an equivalent ICE car. And I think this is part of the transition, that ultimately the monthly cost of an EV has to come in line with an ICE car in order to encourage people to switch. And I think we will see that happen over the course of the next year. And particularly, obviously, as EV output starts to ramp up and there's more efficiencies in terms of building these vehicles, we should see them become more attractive from a price perspective. But I don't think it's actually consumer interest in the product is really, really high, actually. I think it's when people get to the monthly fee that the trade-off is less attractive. And that, I think, is what we need to deal with over the course of the next couple of years, particularly as we move towards 2030.
Yeah, I think that's really going to be difficult, especially because interest rates are not going down anytime soon. The cost of living crisis is still here. People are really watching what they're spending, and actually, it's probably only going to get worse before it gets better. That makes it very difficult to make a decision to go, actually, yeah, no, I do want to go for that electric vehicle, but at a couple of hundred quid a month more. It's not a decision that people can make.
I think it's absolutely right. Yeah.
John, I know that was your last story. I'm just going to wedge one in here, which is more of a plug. So please allow me to do it. Okay. And that is the fact that we published our second podcast in the Car Dealer Inspiring Leaders podcast this week. And that's my chat with John O'Hanlon of Whalen's Automotive. It's a separate podcast that you can find connected to this one in some way, John. I don't know how Spotify or Apple Podcast works.
I think on Apple they're connected.
It's magic. Yeah. Just get out there and search for it. But it was a very interesting chat with John O'Hanlon about how he helped build Ridgeway, sell that business for £107 million, then decide to start all over again and launch Whalen's Automotive with that Volvo dealer back in 2017 to build it up to where it is now. He was very, very open. We had a nice chat about Dash Gupta, who he hired at Ridgeway, and they worked together. He said he was an absolute phenomenon. I hope I've said that right. I can never say that. I can never say that word. But just said how he was a turbo for their business. And just, it was interesting just to hear about how those two worked together and how they built that business. And obviously, ultimately, Dash went off, worked at Marshalls, and then bought Ridgeway. And he was the one who orchestrated that £107 million deal. And it was a lovely story to hear. And John's got a great take on the motor trade, great take on business. So go and listen to that podcast. You can find it on our website, second one in our series of 10. I've really enjoyed talking to some of the most inspiring car dealer leaders over the last couple of weeks, and I'm chatting to some more over the next couple of weeks and months. So go and find that podcast, please, if you like that sort of thing. But plug over, last story, I'm done.
Very good, James. Okay, well, John, before we ask your verdict, are there any stories you think we've missed?
I think that's, I think to your point, John, it's been a busy week, and I think that's a great review. So I think you've a comprehensive walk through the week.
Excellent. Unless some dramatic story breaks in the next half an hour while we're off having our lunch, which would be typical. So I'm going to have to ask you, who do you think is the winner? Who chose the best stories?
Well, it's a challenging one. I think I'm going to have to go for the big motoring world story. Again, I think based on tracking people's helicopters around the country, I think, you know, impressive work aided by Robert Forrester. And I think we continue to see sort of interesting consolidation in the industry, both on the used side and obviously on the new car side with Lithia as well. I think a big trend that we will see more of. So I'm going to opt for that one.
Well done, John. I think a rightful winner this week, because if I'm honest, and I wouldn't say this unless you'd won, but the ULEZ story, I had completely forgotten, even though it's our most popular story of the week. So yeah, you should have won anyway. Well done.
Oh, you're both very kind. Well, all that's left for me to say on that note is thank you to John for judging today. It's been great to have you on. And we do hope you'll come back.
Of course, I'd love to come back.
Definitely.
Anytime. And thank you as well to James for writing all the stories that I talked about and for competing. And thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. So make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you're listening on Spotify, swipe up now and vote on who you think won. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, which of course you do, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk where you'll find that and much more besides. Thanks again. And until next time, goodbye.